it's okay to get frustrated. You're a robot, right? A meat shaped robot. No, meat made robot. Not shaped. a robot of meat. And like, you know, like you, like all the responses that you're having are just like your robot doing robot stuff, you know, like that's just,
like I like how you phrase this as like, you're a person, you're a robot. Scotch. Hey everybody, welcome to episode 299 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam and I'm impressed with all of that diction.
I'm Sam and I got long hair now.
And this is a show where we talk, we'll get into that. This is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is February 19th, 2021. Dunk on everyone.
Grab a beer, because it's February.
Yeah. That's right. Now, before we get started, we have a warning. There will be profanity in this show. So, you know, just enjoy. We'd also like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. We got a new people.
There's some fresh ones on the line.
Ooh. Some fresh ones. Ye old indie guy, a.k.a. Adrian Nelson, says... I finally finished listening to all of your back catalog of podcasts. Oh, wow.
That's a lot.
Wow, have you and me been on a wild ride. Really enjoy the podcast and look forward to it at the end of every week. Plus, I like the new Dev Chat Weekly newsletter. Sweet.
Oh, thanks. Speaking of the Dev Chat Weekly newsletter, we've had four of them now. And they're also, the archives are up. Each one links to the archives. So
they're good.
You should go sign up. I don't yet have a thing where when you sign up, I send you an email that's like, hey, here's the archives. Hey, but, you know, someday we'll add that in there.
Someday.
Yeah, but yeah, go to tinybs.co/devchat.
Yes. And we'll talk more about the dev chat a little bit later in the episode. Yeah. We'd also like to thank CB Game Dev for supporting the podcast, who says, fellow game dev here, love the podcast. You guys always make me laugh. Keep up the great work. Thanks. Very much. And of course, our recurring supporters are also just like, we're just grabbing their money too. We're just getting, oh my God, we grabbed so much money today. I'm very excited about this. Let's talk about life. Let's talk about the world. Let's talk about another world.
Ooh, Mars.
Let's talk about frickin' Mars.
Yeah.
NASA sent the Perseverance rover to Mars a long time ago, actually. Like 7 months ago, they sent it. It got there this past week.
They must have sent it via USPS.
Yeah. You know? They've been having some slowdowns.
Got some dial-up ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this little thing went for 7 months at 12,000 miles per hour, went to Mars, used rockets to slow down to 2 miles per hour, and then used a sky crane to lower this rover onto the surface.
Is this a thing that they've already done in the past, or was the thing I saw about this years ago their computational like thing for what they were going to do with this one?
I believe they also used a sky crane for the Curiosity rover.
I watched that fucking video at the time, years ago. I watched the thing happen, and I was like – I was also playing Kerbal Space Program at the time, I'm pretty sure. But I was like, what in God's name? Like, who? it sounded like the kind of thing that like a bunch of kids would get together, and they would like in their little imaginary, you know, place headspace would conceive of like the coolest shit you could do, right? And like, oh yeah, it's going to come down on rockets. And then like, it's not just going to land though, because that's not very interesting. Instead, it's going to have a crane on it, which sounds so like dumb and impractical,
sky
right?
Sky crane.
Yeah, exactly. But we'll call it a sky crane because now it's cool, right? And it's going to use that sky crane to like drop this little thing. And then that thing's going to be covered in it. Cause that one was also covered in like just the balloons, right? So it could just bounce once it fell. Or was that a different one?
I think
that was a different one.
That's a different one. In any event, like NASA's attempts to throw things onto Mars is amazing. It's incredible. It's just incredible.
Great theater, you know?
So, I mean, and also I was very impressed because I noticed that NASA had blue LED strips in their command center when they were live streaming. And I was like, dope. Awesome. I mean, yes, it's like it's super cool that you guys went to Mars and stuff. But man, those are some nice LED strips. Mm-hmm. I'm a little more impressed with the decorating decisions. So the idea of Perseverance was to go to a place on Mars where there is evidence of ancient liquid water.
Mm.
And they're thinking if there were organic compounds or even single cell life forms from billions of years ago, then this rover would be able to take samples of soil, like drill down, whatever, and try to figure out, you know, are there billions of years old dead bacteriums or something? Something vaguely resembling that. Probably not, though. You know?
Probably not. Probably not. Well, not. But maybe. Not only probably not. I think it's one of those things that it always sounds really cool and like there's good reasons to check these particular spots and all of this, right? But the scale is so off base from what you're trying to accomplish. Because your question here is like, are there organic molecules on Mars that – actually, it's not even that. It's was there life on Mars? And then what evidence could it have left behind? And then how would we find that evidence, right? But if that life was there a few billion years ago of some form we don't understand or know anything about, and now we're sending a tiny-ass robot – I mean it's actually the size of like an SUV, but like tiny-ass relative to the scope of Mars, right? Mm-hmm.
Relative to the scope of the problem.
Of the problem, right. And they were like, ooh, it's going to dig down. It's like, how fucking far? A foot? You know? Like, it's not going to – it's not digging. You know? It's not like a mining – piece of mining equipment. So it's going to like – yeah, I'm trying to think of like a good comparison of like if you were trying to discover something, you know? If you were trying to like find the source of a leak in your house, you know? And then you just looked at a little 1-inch segment of one pipe. And we're like, that's not leaking. I guess there must not be one, right? Like that's kind of what this is.
Well, of course, there wouldn't be the conclusion that there is no life if it doesn't find any.
Yeah.
Or that there was no life, rather. It would just be that, well, I guess this time, you know, we didn't find anything.
Yep.
But I mean, I think what's crazy about it is that this, you know, these rovers that they send, they take years to build and 7 months plus to get there. And, but all they can do is like whatever was kind of pre-decided. Right. And I think that's the real kicker is the rover will land and then like whatever very specific instruments that it has, that's all the information you're going to get. Mm-hmm. Right. Like whatever ways it has of measuring chemical compositions, whatever's the resolution of its camera, like does it have an electron microscope? I don't think it has one of those, right? So
this is true for any scientific endeavor, right? It feels because of the fact that we had to throw a robot onto another planet, you know, from like is it millions of miles away? I assume it is, like really fucking far away, right?
It's quite far.
It's very far away. So we just like throw a robot onto a planet to like investigate this, but it's actually no. And the scale, like it's the scale is easy to understand because it's a tiny robot on a huge planet, right? And we don't know anything. We just sent it with whatever instruments that we had available, right? But the reality is that that's how all of science is done. It's just a little less dramatic, right? But like in the lab that I worked in, it was we were trying to study single cells and how they do different things. And how did we do it? It's like, well, we had these cells that we had available that other people had created, right? And some of them
got these instruments.
Yeah, we've got these instruments, right? That we could afford to buy with our grant money or that we have access to because our institution has them. And then we have to like rent space on them. So we have limited time in which we can use them. So we have to design our experiments to make sure we can like get as many answers as we can as quick as we can there. Each instrument, if it's a microscope, it's like maybe it can see 3 fluorescent colors, you know? So like that limits how many probes we can put on our cells. There's this huge set of like of restrictions to get, and then you're basically saying, okay, I want to know how something really fundamental and cool works about life, right? But I only have $1,000, 5 hours, access to
three colors,
right? And now you're supposed to go answer those fucking questions. Yeah, that's just how all of it works. I think it just really is kind of obvious how futile the exercise is when you throw a tiny robot on a huge planet, you know?
Yeah. It really perfectly kind of encapsulates the problem of the limited resources available to humans relative to the scope of trying to understand everything that's going on around us, you know? But still
very cool.
It's very cool.
So fun. Yeah. I think it's the whole like that arrival of the rover on the planet is such an exciting thing that it's almost to me, it's like, if the thing can land, then everyone's excited. Like, finding stuff is sort of, you know, like, okay. Like, that'll be nice if it happens, but if it lands, like, that's the thing that we planned for, right? Mm-hmm. And that would be really cool. In the same way that I think, Adam, probably, and maybe you can speak to this in your experiments in the past, but, like, having your experiment work out so you could actually see the thing you were trying to see, even if you didn't learn anything after the fact, but, like, popping that microscope for the first time and being like, I see the colors that I attempt to.
I think this is like the fundamental problem of like of regular science that isn't throwing robots at planets. Because regular science, it's not exciting just to have the robot land, right?
Yep.
Or when I say not exciting, I mean like for everybody who you're trying to get to give you money.
It doesn't give you funding.
It doesn't give you funding, exactly.
Right, because what's the alternative? It crashed.
Yeah.
And that's, you know.
But for, that's, but yeah, but for
that's bad.
Yeah, it is, right? But like the having somebody manage to accomplish something like throw a robot on a planet a million miles away, right? With a 7-month journey and have it like all work, right? When there's an 8-minute lag between it talking, between you trying to talk to it and it talking back, right? So that it's just on autopilot landing on a fucking planet at starting at 12,000 miles per hour. The whole thing is so absurdist and amazing that you're right. It doesn't matter actually. It could, it, they could have sent something there that didn't have any instruments at all. They could have sent an American flag.
A cool RC car that just like does ramps off the big dunes of Mars. Everybody be like, yes.
What if they sent a robot that just does the floss dance? It just would land on Mars and just, it would be solar powered.
No. Now that you've
heard, just be perpetually flossing.
This is the kind of thing that Elon Musk would just do.
He would. And you know what? I would support that.
I would like, endeavor. I don't like the guy even a little bit, but I would,
I'd pay good money to see a robot floss on Mars.
I would love to see that.
But he's trying to shoot things at Mars, which I can get behind. So, you know, he's a flawed individual. All right. So, anyways, you know, just wanted to definitely bring that to attention because it's something that doesn't happen very often yet.
Yeah. And well, I think it's also landing on Mars. In a more general point, it's important to do cool stuff and to be proud of the cool stuff that happened independent of the actual outcome, you know? And unfortunately, you can't pay bills that way because not enough people are that into cool stuff as much as they are into things that are supposedly practical. Though I think I would argue against most most of those cases anyway. But like, if you do something cool, even if it leads to failure, like fucking celebrate that, you know?
Yeah. And this is also one of those things that there's like two – it's like a binary outcome. Like if it lands, it's incredible and everybody's overjoyed. And if it crashes, it's horrible and everyone's devastated. Right? And there's not really like a middle ground. We're like, well, it sort of landed. You
know?
Most of the things that would keep it from landing would cause it to smash into the planet at 12,000 miles per hour.
Actually, this is interesting too, right? Because the success failure point of this mission, as far as the public is concerned, is whether it lands or crashes, right? And
everything after that, nobody's going to pay attention.
Nobody's even going to care, right? Like the scientists will care, but nobody else will. But that's the interesting thing though, right? Because supposedly the thing was sent to Mars to learn something about Mars, not just to see if we could
Land.
Not just to land there. And yeah, you're right. People like would have been bummed if it crashed, right? But they won't be bummed if it doesn't find out anything interesting.
Well, I think this is it's actually the same thing, you know, wrapping it back to game dev. When you think about what the game dev journey is, something like getting Level Head out or getting Crash Sense 2 out. 2 to 3 years, aiming for a target that you can't quite see, hurtling toward it at lightning speed with the decisions that you made oftentimes 6-12 months ago being the thing that determines whether it works or not. And it is most exciting on launch day. When the sky crane works and the game arrives, you're like, yes! And I think, you know, importantly for this, I think, Adam, to your point of like knowing which parts to celebrate and when, depending on where you stop the story, it'll be either a success story or a tragedy, right? Where it's like, so say you stop the story at the rover landing and it landed. Amazing, right?
Yeah.
Hoorahs. And then you go like 3 months forward. The rover
got didn't find anything.
Didn't find anything. Got blown over by the first dust storm. It got hit. Not like curiosity. Was all for nothing. huge bummer, right? Yeah, it's. I don't know. It's all. Tough.
But then also you can cast ahead even farther, right? Because like the Curiosity rover is still fucking going. That thing is still going. It's just driving around Mars forever. Just nothing's stopping that thing, right? Like I don't really know if it has found anything necessarily life-changing.
I mean, my life certainly hasn't been changed.
But it's kind of like – it's kind of awesome that it's still going.
Yeah.
Like that's a success, you know?
Yeah.
So
– well, yeah, I think that's it is I think we focus too much on the things that we – or yeah, in certain domains, we focus on the things that we can't control. And we don't celebrate the things that are impressive that we do control. While in others, usually things that we are not the ones doing, we do exactly the opposite, which is not healthy, you know, because like when, yeah, you launch a game, right? The most important thing that you did there actually is lining up all the things, creating the game, doing everything in your power that you could control to create it, to line it up for success, and then to hit go, right? That was the impressive shit. That was the cool stuff. And if you manage to do that with a functional game that people like, that is high quality, that you can be proud of, like, you did it.
Right? You landed on Mars.
The problem is, of course, you can't make money just from landing on Mars, right? but that doesn't mean – the rest isn't something to be bummed about from an achievement perspective. It's something you can be bummed about because, like, oh, well – now I can't do this again because I didn't make any money, right? That's a fair way to be bummed, but a way to be bummed where it's like, this was all for nothing. I didn't do a good thing. This wasn't impressive. Like, none of that's
true. Yeah, don't delete your dope Mars landing progress, you know, just because you didn't find life.
Yep. You got to separate the two parts. Separate the part that you control from the outcome of the part that you controlled and evaluate those independently and celebrate or be devastated by either, you know?
Because the goal wasn't to find life. The goal was to look for life.
Yep.
Because you can't find it if it's not there, right? Yep. There's no – you can't dictate the outcomes. So anyways, very cool. Let's talk about some studio news.
What about it?
So for starters, just another little plug for Adam's Dev Chat newsletter. I've been reading it. I've enjoyed it.
Me too.
Since Adam's the one writing it, I'm going to talk about it, you know, so that it's less biased.
Sure, yeah, do it. Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's very interesting. It's sort of like it's a combo of just like a sprinkling of things surrounding, sometimes like deep dives into very specific technical things, like JavaScripty things and stuff. But also just some higher level analysis on like things happening in the games industry, sometimes even just some life stuff, you know, in a lot of ways it kind of reflects the podcast format, you know, with some more code.
Yeah, sometimes. It's the podcast, but in written form, and then with fewer things covered, and then some of it without worrying about whether or not the particular reader, like any given particular reader, is like, yes, I care so much about that I want to know the tiniest details, right? Because collectively across all of the newsletters that go out, like there's something in there for you.
There's going to be something in there. I got to say, you know, Adam's one of the smartest people I know.
Oh, thanks.
So you can just get his way of thinking about things shot directly into your email inbox, it gives you a nice extra like perspective on stuff, you know, that you otherwise wouldn't have had, which is good.
And I'm also treating it as kind of a way for me to do an initial round of thinking through some problem so I can decide like, does this warrant even further thought so that I should write up like a really in-depth article or something, you know? And then depending on how people respond to that stuff, then that's what helps guide if I'm going to make those things. So by participating and then giving me feedback, you can cause certain things to come into the world that otherwise might not exist.
Yeah. It's pretty neat. So again, that's, what is it? tinybs.co/devchat.
Yep.
Yep. So go there, slap your email in there, and then Adam will tell you things about the world. Let's talk about Crashlands 2 development. So this week has been a lot of work on the first creature, the Slugabuns. We talked about it a bit last episode because we were getting started on figuring out, like, how does it move?
We've just gotten the movement animation done, right?
Yeah. We were talking about its, like, squishy body flopping around movement animation, which is still amazing, and I love it. But what's happened this week?
Well, so you go from having the thing move to the attack side of things. So when you think about Crashlands, you know, the original game, the combat stood out for a lot of people as far as it's essentially, I mean, it's more or less a rhythm situation where you got to dodge the incoming attacks that are very clearly displayed, like where they're going to hit, and then get back in there to you know, do some damage and fight people. So in working on the Slugabuns attack, kind of like with its movement, we wanted to do something that provides some surprises. It's kind of like my whole MO with all the various elements of Crashlands 2 is to have each one of them have some emotional valence to them. So it's like, so you don't just see it and just go like, okay. But rather, at least the first time you see it, that something happens where you're like, what? Or holy shit. Or, you know, maybe even an awe, you know, anything like that. Mm-hmm. So the Slugabun I think pulls this off with its attack, which is it's got this gooey sort of stretchy body and it more or less stands up like a meerkat. And then like its jaw just kind of hits the floor. And it's just got this huge open maw, which is a big surprise because it's very adorable.
There's no state in all of it. So it has a whole bunch of states of being and part of its animations and behaviors, right? There's no one state that when you then see another state, you're like, I expected that to be a follow-on of that first thing.
And so it's very much it's got a lot of, dynamism as far as like what the fuck is happening versus the original, you know, Crashlands. Creatures didn't really change at all because I didn't know how to do that. We didn't really have the animation tools to do it anyways.
We might have had like an open mouth frame for some of them.
Yeah, I think that's basically the extent of it. Open mouth, maybe arms pointed forwards now or something.
but no, that was me. I did that part.
Yeah, you did all those things. So yeah,
I wiggled their arms and coat.
Yep. And then I sort of moved on. And so what's been interesting though is you know, taking that animation, getting it built sort of, because it's a combination of frame by frame stuff and then work inside of Spine to like really kind of emphasize everything. And that process with this first creature has then allowed Seth and I to go back to a lot of the Spine code that we originally put in place to handle the player character and all of its animation states, which also are zany, doing all sorts of stuff. And it's been, I would say it's been a challenging week for me because of the two steps forward, one step back sort of sense of it, where, you know, we basically go a day and make what feels like a bunch of progress, discover something the next day about either how GameMaker handles spine files or how meshes work or like just any part of the pipeline. And then that would require a fundamental rebuild either on my side or on Seth's side. It has happened to both of us, I think, at least two times this week. And so just yesterday, then this attack animation, which had, you know, has been sort of has taken essentially 4 days to get done, which is a long damn time. But in the course of that too, you know, recognizing that we've been figuring out how to do it, which is the big part of where we're at right now. It's kind of the cost of this, of these early phases. Anytime you go, we refer to it as 0 to 1, which is, there is a monumental difference in what you have to do to get from 0 to 1 than to get from 1 to 2. And that's sort of what we've been experiencing, I think, on the Slugabun front this week.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And I think it's
particularly hard once you feel like you've moved beyond the research phase. Cause I think
yes.
that's kind of what I gathered from watching the two of you work this week was that you had kind of felt like, oh, we figured it out. Now let's move ahead and like make this make this first creature fully animated, get it in the game, have it like do all the things. But the reality was that there were still unanswered questions. And so it's that pairing of that fact with the idea that you kind of believe that you were in a new phase, like the production phase.
It's an expectation, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's because the framing there, Sam, was, you know, that you had said like this week has felt like, you know, two steps forward, one step back. Right. And I think that really just does come, like what Adam was saying, it comes from misinterpreting where you are. Mm-hmm. Right. Cause it actually has been, very good forward movement. You know, it just hasn't – there's been roadblocks, and it hasn't been at the pace that you would expect if we were already – if we had already solved all of these, mm-hmm. like, fundamental problems, right? And so I think one of the interesting things we found is that we're using a lot – you know, one of the key mechanics of original Crashlands is the telegraph system where creatures would, you know, telegraph the attack that they're going to do with, like, a cool shape on the ground or something. So, you know, we're leaning into that with Crashlands 2. And the player character has a bunch of telegraphed attacks that they can do. So we have like a sword swing, and the way Sam animated it, there's like a big sweeping smear frame. And it just kind of made it be the case that kind of no matter what shape we made the telegraph for that attack, it still felt good. It felt like it matched, like it fit with the sword attack. And we put in, we're like, cool, we figured out telegraphs, we figured out attacks, we're mm-hmm, good to right. go. One thing we did, right? And then we go on to the Slugabun, and we're working on this bite animation. And we wanted it to have like a pretty big area of impact. And so Sam's animating the chomp, this Slugabun, and he made a pretty dramatic smear frame, but the smear frame just accentuated the closing of the mouth, to make it look like the mouth was closing really fast, right? And when we put it into the game, it just felt boring. Like it was not actually
snapping its mouth shut, even though it was.
It was detached, right? So, yeah. so it was closing its mouth, and there was a telegraph, but they didn't feel connected at all, right? And so this was the point where, you know, originally Sam was thinking like, okay, we have an attack. I just need to animate the bite, and now it's done. And we put it in the game. It turns out it's not done because we missed something.
It doesn't feel like you're being bitten yet. So
yeah, so we went back and we looked at the player, and we're like, how come the player's attacks feel good, but the creature's attacks don't? And we're like, oh my God, it's because the player has this enormous sweeping smear frame that is like so big that any shape or size of telegraph feels connected, right? Yeah. So then Sam went back and was like, okay, I need to rethink how these impact animations work. And so he had to completely rework that whole frame for the slug bun. And then it's great. It feels great now, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I think part of that too is feeling like you've solved a problem just because you've seen it once, you've solved it once in a certain context, and now thinking that you've got the full scope, right? Mm-hmm. When really there's a lot of angles to it, and we're gonna hit these a bunch of times. We're gonna keep uncovering these things as we work through other kinds of animations and other things, and you just gotta kind of like be cognizant and don't. If you hit a point where you suddenly recognize like, oh, actually, turns out we're not as far ahead as we thought we were, right? Then you got to kind of like readjust your expectations. Yeah, you got
to
reset.
I think, you know, this speaks to – we talked about it on the podcast before, but the importance of trying – of remaining in that student mindset where you – instead of saying that you know how to do things and that they're going to get done, you know, in this procedural fashion, this followed by this. You know, recognize, yeah, you can have a plan, but it's far more – the thing you're actually working toward is the target. It's not about the plan. And so being able to kind of separate whatever your daily progress might look like from whatever your planned progress looks like, I do think it's really important. And you're right that it's a hard thing to do. I think, one, if you feel like you already know how to execute something – and then actually two is in the opposite scenario, which is where I think in this case, it both seemed like we knew how to execute something. And then also technically we were doing a bunch of new things, but because we didn't, it wasn't approached in that way where we're like, okay, there's a bunch of new things that are going to happen with this. So like, let's just figure it out.
They weren't obviously new things.
That's the
they were similar. They were similar enough to the things that we've done in the past that we thought that we were going to have all the answers, which, you know, by now we should know better, I think, because.
Well, but you can't though, because that's the core point is that you're always limited by the knowledge you have. And most of the stuff that's missing, you don't know is missing. Otherwise you would have made some effort to, you know, to fill that gap, right? And so most of your efforts in this kind of creative endeavor are in moving forward with the things that you think you know, discovering something that you didn't know that you couldn't possibly have known that you didn't know because
otherwise you would have.
Yep.
And then adapting to that scenario. And so it's a two-parter where it's the moment you just feel like you've got it, then you're just wrong and you're leading yourself to being bummed later on, right? Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you have to also be aware that as a human being, you kind of don't have a choice but to feel like at some point you got it as you start moving forward, right? Because you don't yet know what you don't have, right? And if you don't have at least some confidence that allows you to move forward, then you just kind of sit there, right? Yeah. And so in order to go into the unknown, right, you have to, at least at some level, think you've got it figured out. And so I think it's one of those things that we mentioned this sort of concept of the podcast a lot too of like – of both accepting a thing for being a fact while also not accepting it, right? And it's a hard thing to do. It's the thing that mostly has to be done intellectually. You can't even do it emotionally. So you have to like allow yourself to have the emotional response while intellectually recognizing what's happening and try to get yourself over that hump, right? Mm-hmm. It's a complicated affair.
It's a fine line to walk. And you know, sometimes you just get frustrated and then you gotta step back and reorient.
Mm-hmm. And just understand it's okay to get frustrated. You're a fucking person. You're a robot, right? A meat shaped rope. No, meat made robot, not shit. A robot of meat. And like, you know, like you, like all the responses that you're having are just like your robot doing robot stuff, you know? Like that's just
what's I like how you phrase this as like, you're a person, you're a robot.
They're the same thing.
It's they're the same thing, because as a person, when you're trying to do something and it doesn't work, your programming says it's frustration time. Let's do this.
If you think of yourself as like, as, oh, you're like an entity, you know, I'm an entity with free will. Like everything that happens is because I decided it's going to happen. Everything that doesn't happen is because I'm a failure and I decided it wouldn't happen, blah, blah. If that's how you see things, like, yeah, like you have nothing but despair in front of you, right?
If you just
recognize that you're a robot doing your best, you're going to have robot reactions. Things. There's a whole song for that meme song from a million years ago. It's like, I'm just a cat and I'm doing cat stuff, you know, where it's like, there's just, if you haven't seen it, it's pretty hilarious, but it's just like a video of like cats doing weird cat shit. And the whole song, the only line is like, I'm just a cat and I'm doing cat stuff. Right. And like, anytime, like I'm watching our dumb cats run around the house doing a thing, we're like, why are they doing that? And then I just shrug and say, it's just cat stuff. Who cares?
They're just doing cat stuff.
People are the same fucking thing. We're just doing people stuff. None of it really makes any sense. It's just weird chemicals in our brains causing us to do stuff and respond to things in certain ways. You just got to accept that that's a fact. And it's okay to be frustrated when you shouldn't be and to be sad when you shouldn't be, when you know better, right? Because
that's because it doesn't matter what you
it
know.
It doesn't matter what you
know. You're still going to feel it.
You still are a weird bag of chemicals with like subautonomous, you know, subroutines doing different things independent of each other.
I mean, you have two like brains and then the third one apparently in your gut. You know what I mean? Like you got two lobes. Each one's kind of like doing a lot of stuff, you know.
You can cut like them in half. You can cut them in half. And like, you know, you still have a person when you're done. And when you do weird shit like that, like – I don't know if you've heard of those experiments, but like that a person can cover one eye, right? And they can look at a thing and they can't tell you what it is.
But they can grab it.
Yep. And they know it's there. But then the other part of their brain doesn't know why they did that. And like, there's this weird shit where you're not one thing. You're not a person is a, that's a fake concept, right? You're not an entity with a single mind or whatever. You're a collection. You're an operating system. You're a collection of subroutines all doing their best to work together. It's conflict ridden. You're just doing your best to resolve all these conflicts, right? Like, it's okay. Cut yourself some fucking slack.
This is the interesting thing about therapy and even like operating in a really functional studio environment, which is that so much of it is actually just about lending the appropriate tool to a person to assist with whatever happens after the emotional response. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about this with frustration for me when it comes to feedback. Which is oftentimes, especially in the past, I'd have a very visceral response to feedback. And I mean like sort of just instant rage sort of a response, right? And it basically took years to get to a point where it's not that I don't have that response, but that I can handle it in a way that doesn't cause anything after like a minute.
Because you weren't deciding to have that response to begin with. So how the hell could you decide to not have
it? Yeah, I can't quite – like, there's no way I can quite like, you know, block that flow completely. And so it's all about the tooling on the backside. And I think, you know, when it comes to the Slugabon reverse, I think part of it is just, you know, with one of the actually most interesting things that happened when we finally got the animation in and got this new smear frame in, so it felt like it was biting, was then I was bummed because fighting the thing wasn't actually – fun, because of course all of its fighting code and animation and everything else had been tied up on not having any animations for this stuff in the past, and so it wasn't balanced actually in a way that was super interesting. And so it was that sort of hilarious final bummer of being like, all right, attack animation's done, and then like you're being attacked by it and you're like,
this feels terrible.
And so then I was here's like seven notes for Seth. It's like, fix, you know, make these.
Oh, yeah. We found this time and time again, right? Because like Adam's saying, you can only make decisions in the context and knowledge of the decision being made.
Yeah.
And as soon as any of those things change, you can look back at the decision and be like, oh no, that was wrong, right?
I know nothing. Or I'm such a disappointment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then all you're doing is you're just making another new decision in a new context with some new knowledge that's also probably wrong once you find out some more stuff. And so when we had no animations in the game and we were testing out the interaction system, the way that you knew you were interacting with something was a progress bar that was over your head. Like you walk up to a thing and you're going to like slap it or pick berries off of it or something. And there would just be a progress bar and then there'd be like a little interface pop up like +1 berry. Right. And we kept looking at that and we were like, these interactions are too slow.
Mm-hmm.
They're just taking forever, right? So we made them like 0.2 seconds or something. So it's like that progress bar is just like whipping past. You're just picking berries so fast, like six berries a second. Then once we actually have the characters' arms moving, then suddenly picking berries at a rate of 5 per second seems ludicrous, right? Yes. Because like who's possibly moving their arms that fast? Mm-hmm. So then we slowed it down, Now it's like a half second or even slower to interact with things. And in those cases, it almost still feels too fast sometimes, mm-hmm. right? Because everything's different now.
Mm-hmm. But had you done that without that animation in there, then that would have felt so ungodly slow. You'd have hated every moment of it.
Yep. Yeah. And so this is it's a part of our development style that we've been really trying to lean into more, as well as this idea of like constantly just evaluate the game for where it is. Find the fun in that. And if things change, then, you know, then you look at those things and you reevaluate them and tweak them until they're fun again. So with this creature, like getting the animation in changed everything about how the combat felt. Well, next thing we did, updated all of its combat stuff. Mm-hmm. Now it feels great again, right? So you just got to keep tweaking. So anyways, things are going pretty good with Crash Dance 2 overall. But yeah, you know, sometimes you just get run into these little stumbling blocks. So let's get on to some questions.
Let's do it.
These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. Highest upvoted question comes from Chalosis, who says, did y'all discuss third-party networking solutions like Photon when you were exploring multiplayer? What are the trade-offs between in-house versus external lobby servers and such?
I think a fairly quick answer to this, which is if you're using a third party, so this is getting at the general question of multiplayer seems to be hard. All the developers are like, no. All the players are like, yes. And then all the armchair developers who have never actually developed anything that had to go to production are like, I could do this in a weekend, right?
So that's a good recap of like 5 episodes of the podcast right there.
Right, yeah. So there's this perennial conflict between everybody wanting multiplayer and it being really hard to do. And then, of course, as a consequence, there are lots of tools out there that are supposed to make your life easier. I'm not sure what the one specifically that was mentioned here. But
is it Photon? There's also PlayFab. There's Game Rocket or some shit.
Yeah, each one's solving a different subset of your problems, right? But there are a few of these problems that are considered to be like universal enough that they have a lot of kind of off-the-shelf solutions. In particular, matchmaking and getting one person's device to talk to another person's device, like getting that stuff set up. So that stuff is great. It can be useful. The obvious major problem, two major problems of it are, number one, often they are not fully cross-platform. So even if you have a cross-platform title, there's a good chance you can't just use one off-the-shelf solution, which means now you're doing a fuckload of work because you have to
make. So you can't like use Steam's matchmaking
service. Right, Steam has great services. Epic is working on their own service, although I think Epic's going to open theirs up more generally. But
I think Epic is available for cross-platform stuff now.
I think it is. But Steam's is very Steam, right? And they're great services, but it's only going to work Steam to Steam. So you can't count. So that's problem number one, is you can't know, depending on the tool, you can't know for sure where it's going to work. Problem number two is if there's something specific you need that the tool does not provide, the problem got very hard, right? Because now you have to make it work with that tool and its limitations.
But you often can't tell how the tool works.
Right. By design, because it's supposed to be easy to use, right? And you're supposed to have it's a black box, and you're supposed to have limited ability to do stuff. So if you're doing stuff that's pretty straightforward, that's a kind of a very common use case, there's a good chance that there's some off-the-shelf solution for you that can help with these subsets of problems without also getting in your way, right? So as kind of a random example, something that I've dealt with not with multiplayer, but just with online stuff, is that there are many things that provide solutions for logging in, because logging in is an ass pain, like managing user accounts and all that kind of stuff. And I've been asked in the past, like, why didn't you use, like, because like Microsoft has one through, I think it's through PlayFab, and then Google has one through Firebase, where you can then like
everyone's got their thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Back when we were getting ready to launch Levelhead, none of those big providers had Epic as one of the options. We launched Levelhead on Epic. also Crashlands on Epic at the same time, right? We would have had to then suddenly just not provide an Epic as a login option for our service because we couldn't have used it with the thing that we had, right? The problem, of course, is that I had to build it myself, right? Which is also unpleasant, but it was possible. And so that's what this kind of stuff creates. So the major point here being that is depending on what you're trying to do, and you need to know what you're trying to do, and how much options you need, and whether it's important for the thing to already be ready because you can't afford to make it yourself or don't want to because it's a lot of work and it's a thing you have to maintain now. It's very costly. So if you can do it with something off the shelf, that's going to be probably the better way to do it.
It's always the best, yeah. It's a big if. It's actually much more of a big if than it seems like oftentimes.
Yeah, it's likely better to design your game and your multiplayer strategy around existing tools than vice versa. That's usually a better idea. So there's all of that. So that's one part of this, but the other part of the puzzle, which is the more important one, which is that stuff, that like off the stuff you can get off the shelf, is also the stuff that isn't the hardest part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
So it's a hard part.
It's a hard part because it's all the hard part, right? But it's not the hardest part. The hardest part is how do you manage player sessions, right? Mm-hmm. And what does it mean for data to be being moved back and forth? What kind of a model do you need to know which data is going where? How does each individual game client manage the data coming in? How does it know what's supposed to be happening? Because when you're doing a multiplayer game, every piece of information you get is both in the past and incomplete, right? And it's variably both of those things because there's jitter across a network in terms of time. So it's not just that, oh yeah, I'm just like 200 milliseconds behind. It's you're 200 milliseconds behind on average, right? That's what's actually happening. And so dealing with that then in the context of your specific game.
Yeah, there's not going to be an off-the-shelf.
There's not an off-the-shelf solution for that. Right. Yeah. There are tools that can help you and make certain pieces of it a lot easier, like things that make it easy to just have your game talk to a server, right? Or to have – it's like Amazon Game Tech has all this cool stuff for like making fleets of servers running your game server logic, right? They have a whole bunch of expectations about what that means for you. And so, again, you'd have to design around it if you wanted to use such a thing. But they fix a problem for you, which is that if you're making a multiplayer game with servers, you have to be able to scale it. And it's expensive. Mm-hmm. And orchestrating that across regions – so now you have like one pool and US East and another one in Europe and another one in China, if you can come up with a publishing partner over there, because that has to go through, partners.
It's a huge administrative problem.
It's a huge logistics problem. Yeah. And so you can use these providers to solve that part of the problem like very effectively for you. But still the thing that they don't do is say, what does it mean for this game to be multiplayer? What does that actually mean? How does the data move? Like, what does this do? That's the hard part. So if you can do off the shelf stuff for all the rest, fuck yeah. Like, do it if you can get away with it. But you still are left with the fact that you need a game that two people can play or more that makes sense when two or more people play it, and also makes sense when only one person plays it, hopefully, right? Mm-hmm. And where when data goes missing or when somebody lags out or when – basically when any of the millions of things that can now happen between two people over a network, the consequences make sense. Everything has to make sense the whole time. Like that's what's hard.
Yeah. And I mean, it's hard no matter what resources you have.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Right. Because actually, so I raid with my WoW guild on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Okay. On Tuesday, for whatever reason, only inside the raid area, it's like you basically zone into this area and it's like an instantiated dungeon for you and your friends. Right. It's like no other people from the outside world can see into here. So it's almost like it's on its own session.
When they do those instance things, it literally is that. It's like it's a separate sort of instance of the game that has its own data, right? Its own communication and all that kind of stuff. And it doesn't talk to the rest.
And so on Tuesday this week, something was going wrong with the dungeon servers that handle these sessions. And they were sending updates in 1 second pulses instead of continuously. Oh. So you'd be trying to fight this boss and like you may have gotten hit by something really bad like 3/4 of a second ago, but you didn't know it. And then suddenly you've teleported 16 feet to the right and you're almost dead. Or like the boss will be like doing something and suddenly it teleports through a wall because it actually went around the wall real quick, but you didn't know that. And so now it's on your face. So like we struggled with that for like a half hour trying to kill a boss. It normally was very easy. We managed to kill it, and then we had to just cancel the rest of the raid because we're like, there's no fucking way. And then, so this is, you know, a multi-billion dollar company with all the resources they have for their servers.
And they've been doing this for 20 years. And they've been doing
this for their 30-year anniversary was this year. And then on Thursday, while we're raiding, World of Warcraft, running super great, Discord crashes. And so, but only for half of us. And so then half of us are raiding in complete silence with no way to communicate with our teammates. And it was like people were just popping in and out of Discord. At some point, like suddenly Discord just full screened itself onto my computer and just said 502 bad gateway. And I'm like, shit, alt tab. You're like, so I don't die. And again, Discord, this is their whole thing, right? Yeah. And it's like managing these things in a way that creates a reliable experience. And like most of the time, these services work amazingly, like 99.99%+ of the time.
It's just that time is
which really is an long. Amazing feat. Like
it's amazing
because this is because to me this is the most important thing. This is why the armchair devs. This is why they drive it crazy. It's not even because they're wrong. It's because it also takes away the acknowledgement of how impressive it is when somebody makes a really truly good and reliable multiplayer experience. Especially once you scale it up to like an MMO where you have to manage not just because when you're doing session based stuff, like for a first person shooter where you like go play a 10 minute match,
say Fortnite or Apex Legends,
like one of those things, those are literally infinitely easier to build and for production, right? Because of the fact that you get to assume that any given like group of people playing together will be done within 20 minutes or whatever it is, right? So you literally have to build your whole architecture around how long people play in a given session. When in an MMO, you've got thousands, tens of thousands of people playing, sometimes for hours, even dozens of hours at a time in different groups and moving around the whole fucking world. And the world has to be broken up in ways too, where each part of the world is on a separate server also to manage all of this.
But also
and
there's no load screens.
Yeah, you just seamlessly move people and data between all these things. Like the amount,
it's amazing.
The complexity and the amount of like just amazing work that goes into something like that actually seeming like nothing interesting is happening, right, is fucking incredible. And it's a huge discount to think like, oh yeah, I can just like buy an off-the-shelf product and get this thing to work, right? Or I can get on my local machine, I can get two copies of my game talking to each other. So how hard could this be?
Problem right? solved. Yeah. I'll say though, I think kind of coming back to when we talked about how we decided, you know, not to do multiplayer. It does come back to that idea of like, if you're going to make a multiplayer game, think about the resources you have. Mm-hmm. Think about what you've got at your disposal, and then maybe design the game with those in mind.
Well, I think it's the difference between making a game multiplayer and making a multiplayer game.
Yes.
And I think it's very easy to accidentally swap those or get some sort of, some heart eyes about it, you know, where you're like, we just got to do it because it'd be so cool.
It is cool. Yeah.
It is cool. But yeah, you have to ask the question, like, is it required for the game to function?
And is it worth the cost?
If the answer is no, then like it's probably not worth the cost. Like it's
almost never worth the cost, honestly, unless the game is like really designed for it to make sense.
Be easy, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And especially if like peer-to-peer can work. Because if you can pull it off, if it's a PC-only game, it's only on Steam, you can use their infrastructure to set up peer-to-peer connections. You're not paying for servers, or you don't even have to worry about servers. It's just not even a thing you have to deal with.
Yeah, that's your ideal scenario, basically.
That's your ideal scenario, and where you don't care about lag because you're like, whatever, if people want to connect to each other from Australia and the United States, like fucking let them.
That's their problem now.
I don't care.
And also, you don't care about cheaters because people are deciding who they connect to. Yep. So if they connect to a hacker, then like, well, that's their problem.
Yep. And now you're not dealing about data storage because the data is not being – it's like you might be doing cloud saves, but that's actually just – them making a copy of the game they played locally and you just uploading a static copy versus like if you're running an MMO or something where you have the server, you know, you're dealing with the data lives on the server now. It's being continuously backed up and you have to make sure that nothing gets lost and that if there are any conflicts it gets dealt with because it can have really bad long-term consequences. You have to worry about cheating. Like the list goes on and on and on. So yeah, if you can use off-the-shelf products and do peer-to-peer and you have a really good reason for doing it in the first place, then
go for it.
You can do great. It actually isn't that big of a deal. But as soon as you go beyond that set of things, it turns into
just a waking nightmare.
Just a horrible nightmare.
All right. Next question comes from Bam182, who says, you're coming up on episode 300.
Yes.
300 is a perfect game of bowling. In your opinion, are there any perfect games in the video game world? Not to blow smoke, but I can't think of a single thing to complain about when it comes to Crashlands. Loved every minute of it and can't wait for the sequel. It's just a little plug for Crashlands 2 there from you know,
appreciate
from
that,
a fan. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can think of lots of things wrong with Crashlands. But
me too.
I
have a list.
Well, there are perfect games for you.
Exactly.
Yep.
Because there's no such thing as something just being wrong, right? Or wrong with or whatever. Those are just personal opinions, you know? So if you just get the right intersection of a thing and a person and their opinions, then it could be perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So where does that overlap for you guys?
It's a definitional problem as I see it, right? Because like I love Kerbal Space Program. I love it. Yep. I haven't played it in years. Years. Probably it's been 3 years since I played Kerbal Space Program. But when I was playing it, I put 400 hours into it.
But do you have to continue playing it forever for it to be a perfect thing?
Well, that's the question of definitions, right? Like, what's the threshold? Because I started playing World of Warcraft in 2004, and I still play it. I have tons of friends. It's my number one hobby. And
I would say maybe
it's, but it's got a lot of flaws, right? So like,
think about it like loving stuff. Cause I think the perfection thing is the problem here, right?
Yes.
It's just too loaded. But the question of like, which games have you loved? That's a good, easy one. Cause you can love something despite whatever bullshit it's got going on or because of it sometimes. And a lot of it's timing based too. Cause otherwise you have to get into the definition of like, what the fuck perfect means in this context.
I think there's also maybe the way I think about it is not even about whether you like it or not, but because that is one way we could do it. And another way, though, is to say, does it pull off what it's trying to do? Right. Mm-hmm. So for me, like I would take something like a short hike.
Yeah. Right?
Oh yeah.
Fucking like what it's trying to do. Fucking nails.
Fucking
it. Like,
nailed it.
It would be extremely difficult for anything to accomplish what it did to the same degree of success, right? Mm-hmm. Something like Left 4 Dead.
Yep. Nailed it.
Fucking it. Asymmetrical four-player co-op zombie.
The Vermintide is basically Left 4 Dead again, but, you know, also very good.
Yeah. So maybe a way to think about this is just like, what games just really just nailed it? Like, whatever they were going for, just nailed it.
Yeah, because I think Kerbal Space Program is one of those, too. They fucking nailed it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they're trying to create for you the sense of, like, building a space program, going to space, and, like, the challenge of doing it and the engineering thing is responsible and, like, the successes and the failures and how it's mostly failure when, like, they created the whole thing and they just nailed it. So I think there's actually a lot of examples if you take that kind of a definitional approach to it.
Yeah. And I think that's something you'll always find when you read critical reviews of games is it's always 8 out of 10. It's always 9 out of 10.
Oh, yeah. Your 10 out of 10s only go to basically a triple A level experience.
Right? 10 out of 10s only go to remakes of old games.
That's true, yeah.
Or games in the 16th game in an already existing franchise because you're primed to already love everything about it, you know. Mm-hmm. But – yeah, if you just think about it, like, did this game, is it obvious what they were trying to do?
And did they
and
nail
did
it?
Did they nail
and
it?
Right? And did like, the issues,
sure. There's going to be nitpicks.
Yeah.
There's going to be little, like, weird things.
But
and
do they take away, right?
From the fact that they nailed it.
To even matter. Because I would actually bet that if you took that kind of approach to thinking about rating games, that the gulf would be bigger, right?
Yep.
Where now, instead of being like, oh, like this was overall fun, it's very pretty and whatever, I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10 because there wasn't anything obviously bad about it, right? Like,
right, but did they nail it, though?
Did they nail it? Versus then if something nailed it, you're like, but I didn't like this one piece, so I'm going to knock 2 points off, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter because the question is just did it nail it, right? And I think if you rated things in that way, I think it would be – because the fallout of that question is like, did they nail it? And then after that, is this the kind of thing I'd be interested in?
Right. Yeah, and those are really, I think, two only important questions.
Yeah, and probably. They're separate, right? Because if you're rating how well it nailed it in relation to how much you care about what they nailed, then that's where you start taking away points for no fucking reason, right? Mm-hmm. And in a way that isn't useful for other people. But if instead you can articulate, like, here's what this game is trying to do, therefore who is it for? And here's how well it pulls that off, right?
Then, did they nail it?
Did they nail it?
This is why Cyberpunk, for example, did not nail it.
They didn't nail it.
No.
You know? They just didn't nail it.
Nope.
Maybe, yeah, if the rating system was just nailed it or whiffed it, you know? Like, right. That's, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
Because
yeah,
I'd say, like.
There's a whiff to a nail range. I'm not sure
what's the binary there, but. It's not even dumb. It's not even recommend or not recommend, because I don't know you. I don't know if you should play this game. All I know is, what is this game? And did they nail it or did they not?
Because it could be anything. It doesn't matter how. It doesn't matter. Like, scope doesn't. Like, none of it matters, right? It's just like. It doesn't even matter what they were going for, as long as it wasn't something that.
Did they nail it, though?
Right? It's just, did they nail it? How small?
Like, yeah.
Just doesn't matter. So what? Yeah. What? Who else nailed it? Who else? Yeah,
RimWorld.
RimWorld fucking nailed it.
RimWorld nailed it.
They did.
They just fucking nailed it. Rocket League nailed it.
They Slay the Spire. You know.
Mm-hmm. Slay the Spire
Monster,
nailed
Monster
it.
Train, which is sort of in that.
Golf with Your Friends nailed it.
Mm-hmm. Nailed it.
Subnautica,
What the Golf also nailed it.
Uh-huh. What the Golf? Yeah. I mean, I could tell what they were going for, and it's a weird thing to go for.
But they did it.
But they nailed it.
Weird choice, but impressive execution. You know?
Yeah. Stardew Valley nailed it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You know? Flappy Bird nailed it.
Flappy Bird did.
I mean, it wasn't like he wasn't going for a lot.
But it doesn't matter. The thing he was going for.
Well, maybe that's the note here, which is that, you know, when it comes to your design decisions about your game, it's standard to think of big, flashy stuff. But really, at the end of the day, you just got to ask yourself the question, like,
what can I nail?
And then at the end of the day, like, does this help me nail it or not?
Yeah. That's having it. Less stuff that you just do a better job of is
usually better.
Yeah. Let's think a little bit about a short hike. Is a short hike actually also has sort of, it's a game that isn't simple. It feels like it is because it's short.
Yes.
It would be very hard to build a game like that. So, yeah. You know, so true kudos to having done it. That said, it still is a small scope game, right? Mm-hmm. And relatively speaking, it feels like there's not a lot going on, which again isn't quite true, but it feels like that's what's going on. But it just fucking does it though. Like it just does it so successfully. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, this, I'm really getting behind this rating system because this also sidesteps a lot of other dumb conversations. Like, Firewatch, is it a game? Is it a walking simulator? Mm-hmm. I don't care what it is.
Did they nail it? They did.
Did they nail it? Yeah, whatever they were going for, did they nail it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Now you just tell me if they nailed it and I'll decide if I like the concept.
Yeah.
Right? And then I'll play it if I want to.
And this actually this is a good system too, because I was telling Sam and Seth earlier, but I was watching a YouTube video. A guy did a really in-depth analysis of the old game. Actually, it was called Pro. No.
Pathologic.
Pathologic. Mm-hmm. The second one came out recently also, but the old one was from like 2004. The whole thing is really about how they nailed it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now that I'm thinking about it in these terms. But in explaining that, it had to be explained in the context of what they were trying to do and who it was for, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because that is a game that, unambiguous after watching that show, I do not want to play and have absolutely no interest in playing. I would have a horrible time playing. I would hate every second of it.
Uh-huh.
But I'm convinced that they nailed it. I'm 100% convinced they did, and I get that there are people who would love it, and they would love it because they nailed it, and it's the kind of thing that they're into, right?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And yeah, I think this is a good system. It's all you need.
Mm-hmm.
What were the developers going for, and did they nail it?
Yeah,
that's it.
And that doesn't even mean that anybody wants to play it, right?
Correct.
Yeah,
because that's not even. Reviewer, that's not up to you.
Yeah.
To decide whether people want to play the game.
It's true. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, the whole idea of like a reviewer's job being to sort of, in effect, recommend to you, right? Or to like distill for the universal public, like
how presumptuous.
Good. Yeah.
You don't know me, reviewer.
Yeah, it's wild.
Doesn't you don't know sense. Me. You can't tell me what I should play. Just tell me if they nailed it. All right. So someone of our listenership needs to figure out how to make this be. I'm not going
to
do it. I'm busy.
No, we got stuff to nail.
Make this a thing. Make a site where you just say, like, sum up what the developers were going for, but if you can tell.
Well, and whether if you they can't nailed tell, it. I think usually you don't even, they're not nailing
it. If you can't tell, then they didn't nail it, you know?
This is why I think sometimes you see a game with weird graphics or like hilariously rigged 3D models and stuff. I was watching that Phasmophobia?
Or no?
Phasmophobia? Yeah, there's something.
The one where you do ghost hunting? That one?
Yeah, you do ghost hunting. That game is glitchy as fuck. Like, just hilariously glitchy. But it doesn't fucking matter because they nailed it, actually.
It's like Ark. Ark is the same deal. Ark is probably the glitchiest game I've ever played. Mm-hmm. And, like, yeah, did that, like, pull me out of a few moments and, like, was it hilarious? Sure, yeah, all those things are true, but it doesn't matter for the overall impact of the game, which was that they fucking nailed the experience of, like, you suddenly are in dinosaur times and you get to, like, try to
deal with it.
You know, deal with it. It's just as horrible as it would be in real life, you know? Yeah.
But in a way that nailed it.
But in a way that nailed it.
Not in a bad way.
This is a good, it's a good way to orient our design, our designs around Crashlands as well, you know?
Yeah.
Because so it's, I think that's part of the reason people vibed with the original is because it was doing a particular, even though we couldn't figure out how to talk about it, we couldn't talk about what was nailing it for some reason, but it definitely was doing its job effectively, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, I think it's that people want to be able to put things into a box. Like, you want to be able to categorize things, right?
Right.
And so if you have a game that's doing a lot of different things that don't necessarily neatly fall into a predefined set, mm-hmm. right, of genre, then you don't, you know, you don't have a word for it, right? So people would call Crashlands a survival game, which I think
survival is survival action crafting RPG was my favorite. Yeah.
And I think, like, a survival game is the closest thing you could say that it is because there's open world gathering and crafting, but there's no survival, which is sort of the core thing that survival games are supposed to be about, yep. right? Of like, of scraping by in like a difficult barren wasteland, right? Which is not what Crashlands is. Mm-hmm. But, you know, close enough.
It's a survival game.
Yeah. I always wanted to use the survival term, but it's just so
weird. Yep. Yeah. But if you look at the different things that Crashlands is doing, from like the combat to the crafting to the leveling system to the questing, you know, whatever it is, I think it does a pretty good job mm-hmm. of the things that it tries to do. Of course, we can do better.
But it wasn't even about how well it did those things. It was that those were all in service to the thing it was trying to nail, right? Which was mm-hmm. to be a joyful experience that is mostly you hanging out, doing things that are fun and chill, punctuated by exciting moments without drudgery, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was like – that was the whole thing we were going for, and we did it.
Yep.
Doesn't mean that's what you want, right, as the player, but –
Exactly. We did get game of the year, so I guess we can say we nailed it. We did.
Someone can say we did.
Someone can. Someone did.
So, yeah. So, all right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you all for listening. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Coster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net. And of course, again, you can also sign up for the DevChat newsletter, tinybs.co/devchat.
It's good.
Over at podcast.bscotch.net. We also have links to the Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the podcast archives as well. So thank you all for listening, and we will see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.